ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Late Night Live with David Marr.
Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, has just published a report on what she calls the ongoing genocide in Gaza, which she blames on influential third states that have enabled long-standing systematic violations of international law by Israel.
David Marr, Late Night Live, back tonight from 10 on ABC Radio National.
I thought it was an amazing meeting. He's a great leader, a leader of a very powerful, very strong country, China. There was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made. There wasn't too much left out there.
It may well have been the most significant hour and 40 minutes in global geopolitics this year, Hamish.
Meetings with President Trump don't always go well for other world leaders, but somehow he and Xi Jinping managed to keep things on track this week.
I mean, if this meeting was about putting out the fires of a great power trade war, well, at least you'd have to say the flames seem to be under control, for now anyway.
For now. And I guess the question is, where does that leave us? I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doo, and this is Global Roaming. Yeah, well, we've been sitting here, Hamish, recording as they were meeting, the two leaders, and then they broke up, and we're just sort of gradually grabbing bits and pieces from the meeting. What are you seeing as most important?
In true Trumpian style, the president aboard Air Force One was asked to rate the meeting 1 to 10 out of 10. He gave it a 12, Geraldine. But I guess if the China strategy in this trade conflict was to escalate in order to de-escalate, well, it seems that move has been effective because obviously it was Trump that, in a sense, moved first. He limited the export of these NVIDIA chips to China, obviously so critical for everything that China is trying to develop at the moment. In response to that, the Chinese most recently, of course, protected the export of processed rare earths, and that really inflamed things. But just to kind of go back a little bit, it's about 6 months after Trump slapped those tariffs of 145% on goods from China, and then the Chinese responded with 125% levy on stuff coming from the US into the Chinese economy. So we can kind of see the stages of this, but maybe we're kind of back to square one almost.
Yes. I mean, it remains to be seen quite what is really, what are the sort of key movements that are underway here, because both appear to have blinked, both ramped up and both have blinked a bit. And of this course comes right in the middle of the ASEAN summit in Malaysia and the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, the APEC summit as well. So, I mean, this is all, everyone is trying to work out exactly how those two big powers are going to play each other, which is what we're going to completely focus on this week in our episode.
Maybe it's useful for listeners just to break the Trump and Xi meeting into a few of its parts. There was a lot of expectation going in about what would happen on soybeans because, of course, China had stopped buying US soybeans. That hurt so many of Trump's core constituency in those agricultural belts. Then there's the whole chips and rare earths dimension, which we've already referred to. And the other piece is TikTok. We don't know yet whether anything was resolved in relation to the sale of TikTok. Obviously, Trump wants the American bit of TikTok to be owned by Americans. And on the soybeans ahead of the meeting, in fact, Scott Bessent was already posting on social media saying that there'd been a breakthrough there. coming out of it, the message from Trump was that all of the roadblocks in relation to rare earths had been removed. And we also got a hint that Chinese officials were to sit down with the CEO of NVIDIA. So that would indicate that there has been some kind of breakthrough there. On top of that, Trump says he's going to visit China soon and that after that, Xi Jinping is going to travel to the United States.
Yeah, and what is particularly interesting, I think, is that they apparently also talked about Ukraine, words just coming through now, and they say they're going to work together on it. I don't know whether that means fixing it. I mean, that is an extraordinary development because that's certainly a breakthrough with Xi, who's been, as you know, joined at the hip with Putin. And I might add, Taiwan apparently never came up. So that is a quite unexpected part of this meeting, as far as I understand anyway.
Well, a lot of nice things can be said over a negotiating table, right? And these were two men that met, you know, praising each other, Xi Jinping on the way in, talking about them both as captains of ships in these rocky seas that could be steered through, you know, through their joint efforts. It was all a bit poetic, so maybe they might have been getting a little bit carried away. Now, our guest this week, I think, can speak to all of this and particularly deal our region into it because, you know, who could imagine what the likes of Anwar Ibrahim or Prabowo in Indonesia think of Trump visiting them, saying lovely things whilst slapping these tariffs on them and potentially doing so much damage to their economies. The guest that we're talking to, though, Geraldine, is someone that you've wanted to invite onto Global Roaming for a very long time.
I have indeed. Bilahari Kausikan, he's one of the Asian region's most respected diplomats. He's from Singapore with a very well-recognised career. And he just thinks, I think, so interestingly, so clearly in terms of what might come next. His father was one of the first high commissioners appointed by Lee Kuan Yew, the late Lee Kuan Yew, to Australia. So he certainly does know Australia. He's recently written a Lowy Institute paper provocatively titled The Myth of the Asian Century. So we're very pleased to welcome at this particular time in our lives, Bilahari Kausikan. Bilahari Kausikan, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for inviting me.
I need to tell you how long Geraldine has been talking about getting you on the program, Bilahari, ever since we started Global Roaming.
I've been badgering them.
All right. So I've succumbed their loss. Thank you.
Well, no. You've just got this great sort of fusion of, you know, almost Confucian upbringing with a Western strategic thinking, and it makes you an unusual observer of the region. Certainly the region is, you know, in play, shall we say, right now as we record. Presidents Trump and Xi are expected to be getting ready to meet one another in South Korea. Look, I wonder, Bilahari, what you make of this meeting. Do you think it's particularly significant?
I think it's a significant step forward. I don't think it would change fundamental issues. It will not change the structural reasons why the US and China are locked in competition. But it would certainly, hopefully, it would at least lower the level of tension and perhaps set a foundation for moving another step forward sometime in the future.
And I mean, who do you sort of, I know you loathe binary, you know, pessimism, optimism, yeah. But who do you think has the upper hand, President Xi or President Trump?
Well, you're quite correct. I think that's a very silly way of looking at it, right? But I think in this case, one of the peculiarities of US-China competition at this point of time is that China believes it has the upper hand or leverage over the US. And the US also believes it has the upper hand or leverage over China. And the peculiarity is, I think, both are not incorrect. And that has made it a bit probably more difficult than absolutely necessary to come to this stage. But hopefully they will get over this hump.
So with that as the backdrop, how is this trip by Trump to the region being received? Because on the one hand, pretty friendly, actually, by Trump standards, dancing on the tarmac in KL, very friendly words about the new Japanese prime minister. And yet, on the flip side, the tariffs still in place, Southeast Asian economies particularly hit hard, but also the South Koreans hosting Trump right now, deeply worried about the impact of the tariffs.
Sure. I look, we have always dealt with America much more on the basis of common interests rather than the illusion of having common values. And there's only one America. We have always been very conscious about that. And so regardless of who sits in the White House, we'll find a way to deal with whoever sits in the White House. And that's what you are witnessing. We are much more pragmatic about this than, say, Europeans or even some Australians who spend too much time angsting about an America that perhaps mainly existed in their imaginations.
Mm. Right? So do you see...
They're very fighting words, Bilahari.
Really? Getting overly sensitive, I think.
Do you see Trump as any more, any less unpredictable than other American leaders?
Actually, I have never understood this idea of Trump being extremely unpredictable. During his campaigns, both his campaigns, by the way, he said, I'm going to do this, and he did it. Much more so in the second term than in the first term, but he did it. Now, what he says he's going to do is often exaggerated, but what he does end up doing is in the same direction. So how is that unpredictable? Now, Mr. Trump, to my mind, is the first truly post-Cold War American president.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, let me explain. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the U.S. faces no existential threat anywhere in the world. China is a formidable competitor, but is it an existential threat? I don't think so. Russia is an existential threat to Ukraine, for sure, and probably to the Baltic states and some other the smaller European countries. But to America, no. So facing no existential threat anywhere in the world, why should America, to quote the words of John F. Kennedy at the height of the Cold War, bear any burden, pay any price, and so on? Now, this is not the retreat from the world that is sometimes been depicted as by Trump's enemies, I may add. It is actually a unilateral redefinition of the terms of by which America engages the world. It's going to be America that engages the world on the basis of a narrower definition of its national interests, a much more transactional definition of its national interests. Now, you mentioned tariffs a moment ago. Now, why was the United States for many years quite generous about opening its markets to the world? Not out of innate altruism, not out of innate ideological conviction that on the superiority of free trade, because free trade has always been highly contentious in the American body politic. They opened their markets in a very generous way as a weapon against the Soviet Union to bind their allies to their side. Right? Now, no Soviet Union. It's entirely logical you put America first. Putting America first is what I meant by a narrower interpretation of its natural interests and a much more transactional interpretation. Now, that's not unusual, you know. Everybody puts themselves first.
Does the modern Asian region fit into this then? Because there is a view that he's going to pull, he's not interested in this region.
Well, I think he is interested in this region because he's not a fool. He knows this is still, despite all the problems we have, the fastest growing region. And he doesn't like to be seen to be a loser. To give up on this region would be to give up the fastest growing region in the world. So why would he do that? He wants a different deal with this region. You know, his calculation is a brutally simple one. Simplistic even, but not wrong. He looks at Europe and says, can you guys deal with Russia without me minimally at your back? And the answer is no. So the hell with you, you do as I tell you. He looks at Asia and says, can you guys balance China without me at your back minimally? No? Then you pay for the privilege of me being around. So I don't think he's going to abandon the region in his own interest, not out of altruism, not out of generosity, not because he loves our faces, he thinks we're all nice people, but in his own interest. By the way, a lot of things Mr. Trump has done, his unilateralism, his penchant for threats, his disdain for multilateralism, his preference for bilateralism, these are not traits he invented. They have always been present in American political culture. The shining city on the hill has always cast very dark shadows, but those shadows have always been more evident to people who live below the hill rather than people who live on the hill, right? Okay, so I don't think this is very new. Mr. Trump is an extreme version of traits that we have had to deal with for many decades, and we have learned to deal with it. We may not like dealing with it, but we can deal with it. As I said, the shining city on the hill, we have never idolized it. That's why I said some American allies, I don't think the Japanese, by the way, but certainly some Australians of whom I know and I consider my friends, had an idea of America that ceased to exist long time ago and perhaps only existed in their imaginations and the imaginations of their American friends.
Well, in fact, you do sort of say that, and you're demonstrating it very vividly right now, that Asian perspective is far more fluid, except that a lot of this has happened before. Time and again, you've had to adapt. But, you know, Australians do like to be a little bit more clear cut, I think you'd say, in our approach in terms of managing all this volatility. What do you suggest, therefore, that how we approach this, do we have to learn these inconsistent methods that you say sort of characterize Asian diplomacy?
Well, I think you must, because Australia had that attitude because of the luxury of distance, right? Well, that distance is no longer a factor for anybody, right? So you have to adapt to a new reality. Look, the Australian attitude, the Australian strategic posture, and I'm simplifying here, I know, right, was essentially, let's look around for the strongest power that shares something of our values or our interests, and let's hug it. It used to be Britain, then it was America. Now, what do you do if you have a power that is extremely transactional? You have to adapt to it. I think you are adapting to it, by the way, because you are not merely relaxed, nice people, but you're also quite pragmatic people when push comes to shove.
So in terms of the way Southeast Asia responds to this scenario, I think the comments recently from your Prime Minister in Singapore, Lawrence Wong, are kind of interesting because he seems to be reflecting an argument that you've made, which is that this increased contest between great powers, China and the United States, might push countries, particularly in this region, more towards multipolarity groupings, you know, partnerships, groupings that offset the influence of a big or a giant superpower. This is what Lawrence Wong had to say.
I think we cannot afford to just wait for things to happen or hope somehow that things magically will fall in place. We have to take actions now, plan now and start taking actions to invest together in tackling the problems of the global commons, or in building new trade connections and keeping up the momentum of trade liberalization. So that's something that Singapore is keen to do. We can't do it alone, but we will do it with other like-minded countries.
That's Lawrence Wong there speaking to the FT recently, Bilahari.
Yes, I think that's a very Singaporean attitude. There's no point sitting around wringing your hands in despair, gnashing your teeth and rending your garments. Go out and see what can be done. And there's a lot that can be done, I think. Look, it's not new again, you know. Mr. Trump 1.0 rubbished the TPP before he even knew clearly what it was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Australia, Japan, Singapore, we got together and we had the CPTPP, right? We have new things coming up. There's this thing called FIT, Future Investment and Trade Partnership. You know, it's a small group that Singapore is trying to start. It may or may not come to anything, but there are things you can do. We can work together. I see a future of this region of clusters of countries forming around different issues, reforming around other issues. Some may well include the United States. Some may well include China, but not the United States. Some may exclude both. Some may include both. But I see this kind of more fluid system approaching. In any case, it's much better than sitting around and, you know, grumbling and wringing your hands in despair.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's Global Roaming. It's Hamish here.
And it's Geraldine Doogue here.
And we're speaking to one of Geraldine's favourite thinkers, the Singaporean diplomat Bilahari Kausikan.
Yes, and he's about to deliver some pretty devastating verdicts on the people of Taiwan and the choices they're about to make.
Yeah, and maybe offer some advice, thoughts for us as we confront this more challenged dynamic in the region. I've been thinking about this a lot in the last week because we did a recent episode, Bilahari, where we, Geraldine and I got into a bit of a tangle about whether or not China has genuine territorial ambitions in the region. And, you know, I guess we need to distinguish genuine territorial ambitions from other leadership or dominance ambitions in the region. But I think there's a strain of thinking here in Australia, in part because we probably are a bit skeptical of American leadership in the world, that maybe China is benign in its ambitions for the region. And then I think when the conversation comes to the way it's perceived or viewed in Southeast Asia, and I know some of our listeners agree with Geraldine on this. They've written to us this week saying, you know, they really like that Geraldine is fighting against the kind of China threat narrative. But I wonder whether that slightly diminishes the right of nation states in Southeast Asia to determine what their region looks like and whether or not they even have a genuine version of sovereignty.
Just before you come in, I realise what I said was I don't think China is aggressive as such. I think it can be oppressive, but not aggressive in that sense, Bilahari. That's what I was trying to sort of wrestle with.
Okay, if you're on the receiving end, that is a bit of a distinction without much difference, but never mind about that. All right, but I think, look, nobody in Southeast Asia thinks of China as a clear-cut threat. We don't expect the PLA to come marching down and occupy us and so on. On the other hand, we haven't forgotten, it was not that long ago that China was actively supporting communist insurgency movements in most of ASEAN countries, the original five anyway, right? Now, the real China threat is not... China can be pretty aggressive in pursuing its interests. You just ask any Filipino, right? Ask any Vietnamese in the South China Sea and so on, right? But what it wants is to restore something of what it imagined, the position it imagines it occupied in the past, at the head of a regional hierarchy. What that implies is, I'm not going to occupy you. You know, you all are very strange countries. You know, the weather is not very nice. And so why should I occupy you physically? But I want you to subordinate yourself to me. I want you to define your interests in terms of my interests. In other words, I want you all to be something less than fully sovereign. Now, this, I think, is going to be resisted. We want to work with China. We don't consider China a threat in the sense that, as I said, the PLA is not going to come marching down and occupy us. But we wish to maintain our own autonomy. We wish to maintain our own ability to determine our own destiny and to define our interests in a way that suits us best, not suits some other power best. And I'm surprised that, you know, Australians don't see this, because not too long ago, they tried it on you too.
So Taiwan, in this puzzle that we're talking about, you have written and expressed some concerns that maybe Trump might just use Taiwan as a pawn, a bargaining chip in the broader picture. How genuinely concerned are you that that might happen?
I think a lot will depend on the Taiwanese themselves, how skillfully they play this game. I don't think Trump thinks much about Taiwan or deeply about Taiwan. What he has said is that it's very small, it's rather far away, hard to defend, you know. And that is actually, I think, a very fundamental American attitude. Only Joe Biden, of all American presidents that I can recall, was clear, I will help Taiwan, right? Everybody has, as a matter of policy, maintain some ambiguity about what they're going to do, right? Now, I don't think it's going to be something as crude as, all right, you know, you buy my soybeans, I give you Taiwan. It's not going to be so silly as that, right? But I think the key factor here is Taiwan. What I see in Taiwan developing over the last few years, or over the last few decades, actually, is a diminution in their will to defend themselves, and a concomitant rise in their sense of entitlement that somebody's going to help me. Now, that is a kind of attitude that is not going to play well in a more transactional America that defines its interests narrowly. I was in Taiwan not so long ago, and I thought they took away the wrong lesson from Ukraine. The lesson they took from Ukraine is, if I'm a democracy, people will help me. What they fail to notice is the Ukrainians are doing a hell of a lot to help themselves, and therefore people are helping them. I don't see the Taiwanese having that same will to defend themselves. They can't even pass a defense budget through the legislative yuan. Now, that does not seem to me to signify a very high level of determination, bipartisan or trans-political determination to defend yourself. Now, this kind of attitude is not going to play well in the new United States.
That's a pretty dangerous conclusion that you're drawing then for the Taiwanese as to where this
heads. I have told them what my conclusion is, but who am I? You know, who are any of us? We can tell you what we think is good for you, but in the end you have to decide what's good for yourselves.
Well, that exemplifies what you say, which sitting here in Asia, you need a sort of cold-blooded, almost clinical approach to the turn of events and your diagnoses, and you've certainly demonstrated that. Look, Bilahari Kausikan, thank you so much indeed. It's been fabulous to wait for you to join us. I'm really grateful for your time.
No, it's fun talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
So now, what did you make of this man who I was so keen to hear from? I just love his analysis.
I'm just tangling with the Taiwan stuff because
it's pretty strong.
Yes. And honestly, it is ultimately unclear which way Taiwan is sort of leaning at the moment. You know, various different threads emerging within the domestic politics of the place at the moment. What do I think? As always, the view within Southeast Asia of the US-China question is far more wrinkled, I think, than the way we tend to view it. Mm. I guess we have come at this a few times, this idea that, yes, Trump as a personality maybe is an aberration within the kind of the long history of US presidents, but is it a different version of the United States? Like, they have always played a very tough game. They have always wanted to extract something in return for whatever it is that they're offering. And, you know, maybe we are a little bit deluded in viewing it as this light on the hill and seeing the relationship on the basis of values terms. And this is something as a nation we're wrestling with at the moment. If the core alliance is based on common values, well, under Trump, what are those common values? And so, you know, there is something there, I think, for us to take away in our consideration.
Look, I think he sort of almost personifies the notion that
Bilahari does.
To protect oneself and one's peoples, you have to walk both sides of the street. Which I think, you know, we've had this great search for the great and powerful friend that has dominated, our European settlement ideas. And I think for a while now that has become, some of us have become aware that that may not be fit for purpose. So then we're trying to work out, well, what becomes a new guiding principle? And it's very difficult. I never, ever underestimate the difficulty of trying to work this through. And, you know, his invitation that you've got to be clinical and almost cold-blooded in your approach. Again, that's not us. It hasn't been us. Does it have to become us?
We're a bit emotionally connected.
We that's right.
Maybe we're too emotional about it all.
I couldn't agree more. But to hear him say, we are actually making progress on being pragmatic, I think that's the first time I've heard him, I followed him for a while, speaking quite like that. So I actually thought that was quite a plus to hear.
Well, before we get to recommendations, thanks for all your feedback on our main episode about China last week. We will get to some of that feedback in the coming weeks. If you missed it, really encourage you to go back and take a listen. It's about what's happening inside China at the moment, economically, politically, and provides quite a bit of context for the meeting this week between Trump and Xi. And by the way, we've also done a bonus episode drop this week. It's in your feeds at the moment. Geraldine, you had a sort of Irish catch up Was what, a little you got an Irish that. Jig?
Yes, with an Irish economist, David McWilliams, who was most entertaining, I think, really about whether we face a crash. And, you know, every day something new emerges about somebody arguing about precisely that. A bit disconcerting to listen to at times, but to talk about it the way David does, I think, with all his humour, makes it a little bit more bearable.
Recommendations?
I'm going to recommend this Myth of the Asian Century, which Bilahari has written, K-A-U-S-I-K-A-N. It's a penguin special. It won't, you know, threaten the forest. It's short sentences, delightfully, I think, written in a way that Australians really like. And once you've read it, I don't think you emerge with the same view about our region as you did before you went into it. So now what are you going to recommend, Hamish?
So I've had the opportunity this week to sit down and talk to George Williams, so constitutional scholar turned vice-chancellor of University of Western Sydney. He's written a new essay. It's called Aiming Higher, Universities and Australia's Future. Now, bland title, but George, as always, very big brain, big thinker. He's very interested in the role of universities in this new world we're entering into, where AI may in fact dominate, where different kinds of jobs and skills are going to be required. He's got some big thoughts about the way in which universities need to adapt to help us as a nation face some of the really big challenges and confusing things that are coming at us, particularly around skills. You know, we talk about skills a lot, but there's, I guess, a kind of renewed focus on that because AI is coming for so many jobs. It's called Aiming Higher, Universities and Australia's Future. I think it's well worth a read.
I saw that. I'm glad you did it. I haven't read it yet. I thought I must read that. Well, look, thank you again for all your fabulous feedback. Very good feedback for both episodes, actually. Keep your emails coming, global.roaming.abc.net.au. And we really will try before the end of the year to get to some of the suggestions you're making. Thanks to our producer, Taryn Priyadko. And Hamish, see you later.
See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.